They laughed together as though they were all sisters. The two girls had an enjoyable day and thanked Winnie, saying that they would like to return. As it turned out, this was not to be, for in traveling to Orlando they had, of necessity, sat in a non-white carriage. There were no white trains to Orlando for the simple reason that no whites went to Orlando. As a result, they attracted a great deal of attention, and it was soon widely known that two Africana wardresses from the fort had visited Winnie and me. This was not a problem for us, but it proved to be one for them. The prison authorities dismissed them. We never saw nor heard from them again. Chapter 29. For 6 months, ever since the end of the preparatory hearings in January, we had been awaiting and preparing for our formal trial, which was to commence in August 1958. The government set up a special high court. Mr. Justice F. L. Rumpf, president of the three-man court, Mr. Justice Kennedy, and Mr. Justice Ludorf. The panel was not promising. It consisted of three white men, all with ties to the ruling party. While Judge Rumpf was an able man and better informed than the average white South African, he was rumored to be a member of the Broederbond, a secret Africana organization whose aim was to solidify Africana power. Judge Ludorf was a well-known member of the National Party, as was Judge Kennedy. Kennedy had a reputation as a hanging judge, having sent a group of 23 Africans to the gallows for the murder of two white policemen. Shortly before the case resumed, the state played another unpleasant trick on us. They announced that the venue of the trial was to be shifted from Johannesburg to Pretoria, 36 miles away. The trial would be conducted in an ornate former synagogue that had been converted into a court of law. All of the accused, as well as our defense team, resided in Johannesburg, so we would be forced to travel each day to Pretoria. The trial would now take up even more of our time and money, neither of which we had in abundance. Those who had managed to keep their jobs had been able to do so because the court had been near their work. Changing the venue was also an attempt to crush our spirits by separating us from our natural supporters. Pretoria was the home of the National Party, and the ANC barely had a presence there. Nearly all of the 92 accused commuted to Pretoria in a lumbering, uncomfortable bus with stiff wooden slats for seats, which left every day at 6 in the morning and took 2 hours to reach the old synagogue. The round trip took us nearly 5 hours, time far better spent earning money to pay for food, rent, and clothes for the children. Once more, we were privileged to have a brilliant and aggressive defense team, ably led by advocate Israel Mazels, and assisted by Bram Fisher, Rex Welsh, Vernon Beranger, Sidney Kentridge, Tony O'Dowd, and G. Nicholas. On the opening day of the trial, they displayed their combativeness with a risky legal maneuver that a number of us had decided on in consultation with the lawyers. Izzy Mazels rose dramatically and applied for the recusal of Judges Ludorf and Rumpf on the grounds that both had conflicts of interest that prevented them from being fair arbiters of our case. There was an audible murmur in the courtroom. The defense contended that Rumpf, as the judge at the 1952 defiance trial, had already adjudicated on certain aspects of the present indictment, and therefore it was not in the interest of justice that he try this case. We argued that Ludorf was prejudiced because he had represented the government in 1954 as a lawyer for the police when Harold Wolpe had sought a court interdict to eject the police from a meeting of the Congress of the People. This was a dangerous strategy, for we could easily win this legal battle, but lose the war. Although we regarded both Ludorf and Rumpf as strong supporters of the National Party, there were far worse judges in the country who could replace them. In fact, while we were keen to have Ludorf step down, we secretly hoped that Rumpf, whom we respected as an honest broker, would decide not to recuse himself. Rumpf always stood for law, no matter what his own political opinions might be, and we were convinced that when it came to law, we could only be found innocent. That Monday, the atmosphere was expectant when the three red-robed judges marched into the courtroom. Judge Ludolf announced that he would withdraw, adding that he had completely forgotten about the previous case. But Rampf refused to recuse himself, and instead offered the assurance that his judgment in the Defiance case would have no influence on him in this one. To replace Ludolf, the state appointed Mr. Justice Becker, a man we liked right from the start, and who was not linked to the National Party. We were happy about Rampf's decision. After the success of this first maneuver, we tried a second, nearly as risky. We began a long and detailed argument contesting the indictment itself. We claimed, among other things, that the indictment was vague and lacked particularity. We also argued that the planning of violence was necessary to prove high treason, and the prosecution needed to provide examples of its claim that we intended to act violently. It became apparent by the end of our argument that the three judges agreed. In August, the court quashed one of the two charges under the Suppression of Communism Act. On October 13th, after two more months of legal wrangling, the Crown suddenly announced the withdrawal of the indictment altogether. This was extraordinary, but we were too well versed in the devious ways of the state to celebrate. A month later, the prosecution issued a new, more carefully worded indictment and announced that the trial would proceed against only 30 of the accused. The others would be tried later. I was among the first 30, all of whom were members of the ANC. Under the new indictment, the prosecution was now required to prove the intention to act violently. As Perrault put it, the accused knew that the achievement of the goals of the Freedom Charter would necessarily involve the overthrow of the state by violence. The legal sparring continued through the middle of 1959, when the court dismissed the Crown's indictment against the remaining 61 accused. For months on end, the activity in the courtroom consisted of the driest legal maneuvering imaginable. Despite the defense's successes in showing the shoddiness of the government's case, the state was obdurately persistent. As the Minister of Justice said, "This trial will be proceeded with, no matter how many millions of pounds it costs. What does it matter how long it takes?" Just after midnight on the 4th of February, 1958, I returned home after a meeting to find Winnie alone and in pain, about to go into labor. I rushed her to Baragwanath Hospital, but was told that it would be many hours before her time. I stayed until I had to leave for the trial in Pretoria. Immediately after the session ended, I speeded back with Duma Nokwe to find mother and daughter doing extremely well. I held my newborn daughter in my arms and pronounced her a true Mandela. My relative, Chief Mdingini, suggested the name Zinani, which means, "What have you brought to the world?" A poetic name that embodies a challenge, suggesting that one must contribute something to society. It is a name one does not simply possess, but has to live up to. My mother came from the Transkei to help Winnie, and planned to give Zinani a Xhosa baptism by calling in an Inyanga, a tribal healer, to give the baby a traditional herbal bath. But Winnie was adamantly opposed, thinking it unhealthy and outdated, and instead smeared Zinani with olive oil, plastered her little body with Johnson's baby powder, and filled her stomach with shark oil. As soon as Winnie was up and about, I undertook the task of teaching the new mother of the household how to drive. Driving in those days was a man's business. Very few women, especially African women, were to be seen in the driver's seat. But Winnie was independent-minded and intent on learning, and it would be useful because I was gone so much of the time and could not drive her places myself. Perhaps I am an impatient teacher, or perhaps I had a headstrong pupil, But when I attempted to give Winnie lessons along a relatively flat and quiet Orlando road, we could not seem to shift gears without quarreling. Finally, after she had ignored one too many of my suggestions, I stormed out of the car and walked home. Winnie seemed to do better without my tutelage than with it, for she proceeded to drive around the township on her own for the next hour. By that time, we were ready to make up, and it is a story we subsequently laughed about. Married life and motherhood were an adjustment for Winnie. She was then a young woman of 25 who had yet to form her own character completely. I was already formed and rather stubborn. I knew that others often saw her as Mandela's wife. It was undoubtedly difficult for her to create her own identity in my shadow. I did my best to let her bloom in her own right, and she soon did so, without any of my help. Chapter 30. On April 6, 1959, on the anniversary of Jan van Riebeck's landing at the Cape, a new organization was born that sought to rival the ANC as the country's premier African political organization and repudiate the white domination that began three centuries before. With a few hundred delegates from around the country at the Orlando Communal Hall, the Pan-Africanist Congress launched itself as an Africanist organization that expressly rejected the multiracialism of the ANC. Like those of us who had formed the Youth League 15 years before, the founders of the new organization thought the ANC was insufficiently militant, out of touch with the masses, and dominated by non-Africans. Robert Sobukwe was elected president, and Potlako Lebalo became national secretary, both of them former ANC youth leaguers. The PAC presented a manifesto and a constitution, along with Sobukwe's opening address, in which he called for a government of the Africans, by the Africans, and for the Africans. The PAC declared that they intended to overthrow white supremacy and establish a government Africanist in origin, socialist in content, and democratic in form. They disavowed communism in all its forms and considered whites and Indians foreign minority groups, or aliens, who had no natural place in South Africa. South Africa was for Africans, and no one else. The birth of the PAC did not come as a surprise to us. The Africanists within the ANC had been loudly voicing their grievances for more than 3 years. In 1957, the Africanists had called for a vote of no confidence in the Transvaal executive at the National Conference, but had been defeated. They had opposed the Election Day stay-at-home of 1958, and their leader, Potlako Lebalo, had been expelled from the ANC. At the November 1958 ANC conference, a group of Africanists had declared their opposition to the Freedom Charter, claiming it violated the principles of African nationalism. The PAC claimed that they drew their inspiration from the principles surrounding the ANC's founding in 1912, but their views derived principally from the emotional African nationalism put forth by Anton Lembede and A.P. Mda during the founding of the Youth League in 1944. The PAC echoed the axioms and slogans of that time, Africa for the Africans and a United States of Africa. But the immediate cause for their breakaway was their objection to the Freedom Charter and the presence of whites and Indians in the Congress Alliance leadership. They were opposed to interracial cooperation in large part because they believed that white communists and Indians had come to dominate the ANC. The founders of the PAC were all well known to me. Robert Sobukwe was an old friend. He was the proverbial gentleman and scholar. His colleagues called him Prof. His consistent willingness to pay the penalty for his principles earned my enduring respect. Potlako Lebalo, Peter Raboroko, and Zephania Motopeng were all friends and colleagues. I was astonished and indeed somewhat dismayed to learn that my political mentor, Gwa Hadebe, had joined the PAC. I found it curious that a former member of the Communist Party's Central Committee had decided to align himself with an organization that then explicitly rejected Marxism. Many of those who cast their lot with the PAC did so out of personal grudges or disappointments, and were not thinking of the advancement of the struggle, but of their own feelings of jealousy or revenge. I have always believed that to be a freedom fighter, one must suppress many of the personal feelings that make one feel like a separate individual rather than part of a mass movement. One is fighting for the liberation of millions of people, not the glory of one individual. I am not suggesting that a man become a robot and rid himself of all personal feelings and motivations, but in the same way that a freedom fighter subordinates his own family to the family of the people, he must subordinate his own individual feelings to the movement. I found the views and the behavior of the PAC immature. A philosopher once noted that something is odd if a person is not liberal when he is young and conservative when he is old. I am not a conservative, but one matures and regards some of the views of one's youth as undeveloped and callow. While I sympathized with the views of the Africanists and once shared many of them, I believed that the freedom struggle required one to make compromises and accept the kind of discipline that one resisted as a younger, more impulsive man. The PAC put forward a dramatic and overambitious program that promised quick solutions. Their most dramatic and naive promise was that liberation would be achieved by the end of 1963, and they urged Africans to ready themselves for that historic hour. In 1960, we take our first step, they promised. In 1963, our last toward freedom and independence. Although this prediction inspired hope and enthusiasm among people who were tired of waiting, it is always dangerous for an organization to make promises it cannot keep. Because of the PAC's anti-communism, they became the darlings of the Western press and the American State Department, which hailed its birth as a dagger to the heart of the African left. Even the National Party saw a potential ally in the PAC. They viewed the PAC as mirroring their anti-communism and supporting their views on separate development. The Nationalists also rejected interracial cooperation, and both the National Party and the American State Department saw fit to exaggerate the size and importance of the new organization for their own ends. While we welcomed anyone brought into the struggle by the PAC, the role of the organization was almost always that of a spoiler. They divided the people at a critical moment, and that was hard to forget. They would ask the people to go to work when we called a general strike, and make misleading statements to counter any pronouncement we would make. Yet the PAC aroused in me the hope that even though the founders were breakaway ANC men, unity between our two groups was possible. I thought that once the heated polemics had cooled, the essential commonality of the struggle would bring us together. Animated by this belief, I paid particular attention to their policy statement and activities, with the idea of finding affinities rather than differences. The day after the PAC's inaugural conference, I approached Sobukwe for a copy of his presidential address, as well as the Constitution and other policy material. Sobukwe, I thought, seemed pleased by my interest and said he would make sure I received the requested material. I saw him again not long afterward and reminded him of my request, and he said the material was on its way. I subsequently met Patlako Lebalo and said, "Men, you chaps keep promising me your material, but no one has given it to me." He said, "Nelson, we have decided not to give it to you because we know you only want to use it to attack us." I disabused him of this notion, and he relented, giving me all that I had sought. Chapter 31. In 1959, Parliament passed the Promotion of Bantu Self-Government Act, which created 8 separate ethnic Bantustans. This was the foundation of what the state called Groot or Grand Apartheid. At roughly the same time, the government introduced the deceptively named Extension of University Education Act, another leg of Grand Apartheid, which barred non-whites from racially open universities. In introducing the Bantu Self-Government Act, Dr. Vet Nel, the Minister of Bantu Education and Development, said that the welfare of every individual and population group could best be developed within its own national community. Africans, he said, could never be integrated into the white community. The immorality of the Bantustan policy, whereby 70% of the people would be apportioned only 13% of the land, was obvious. Under the new policy, even though 2/3 of Africans lived in so-called white areas, they could only have citizenship in their own tribal homelands. The scheme gave us neither freedom in white areas nor independence in what they deemed our areas. Fervoort said the creation of the Bantustans would engender so much goodwill that they would never become the breeding grounds of rebellion. In reality, it was quite the opposite. The rural areas were in turmoil. Few areas fought so stubbornly as Zeerust, where Chief Abram Mwilwa, with the able assistance of advocate George Bizos, led his people to resist the so-called Bantu authorities. Such areas were usually invisible to the press, and the government used their inaccessibility to veil the cruelty of the state's actions. Scores of innocent people were arrested, prosecuted, jailed, banished, beaten, tortured, and murdered. The people of Sekukunaland also revolted, and the paramount chief, Moramotso Sekukuna, Godfrey Sekukuna, and other councillors were banished or arrested. A Sekukune chief, Kolane Koloko, who was perceived as a government lackey, was assassinated. By 1960, resistance in Sekukunaland had reached open defiance, and people were refusing to pay taxes. In Zeerust and Sekukunaland, ANC branches played a prominent part in the protests. In spite of the severe repression, a number of new ANC branches sprang up in the Zeerust area, one of them having recruited about 2,000 members. Sekukunaland and Zeerust were the first areas in South Africa where the ANC was banned by the government. Evidence of our power in these remote areas. Protest erupted in eastern Pondoland, where government henchmen were assaulted and killed. Tembuland and Zululand fiercely resisted and were among the last areas to yield. People were beaten, arrested, deported, and imprisoned. In Tembuland, resistance had been going on since 1955, with Zapata part of the forces of protest. It was especially painful to me that in the Transkei, the wrath of the people was directed against my nephew and one-time mentor, K.D. Matanzima. There was no doubt that Daliwanga was collaborating with the government. All the appeals I had made to him over the years had come to naught. There were reports that impis, traditional warriors, from Matanzima's headquarters had burned down villages that opposed him. There were several assassination attempts against him. Equally painful was the fact that Winnie's father was serving on Matanzima's council and was an unwavering supporter. This was terribly difficult for Winnie. Her father and her husband were on opposite sides of the same issue. She loved her father, but she rejected his politics. On a number of occasions, tribesmen and kinsmen from the Transkei visited me in Orlando to complain about chiefs collaborating with the government. Zapata was opposed to the Bantu authorities and would not capitulate. But my visitors were afraid that Matanzima would depose him, which is eventually what happened. At one time, Daliwanga himself came to visit during the treason trial, and I brought him with me to Pretoria. In the courtroom, Izzy Mazels introduced him to the judges, and they accorded him a seat of honor. But outside, among the accused, he was not treated so deferentially. He began aggressively to ask the various defendants who regarded him as a sellout why they objected to separate development. Lillian Ngoyi remarked, "Gracious, this man is provocative." Chapter 32. It is said that the mills of God grind exceedingly slowly, but even the Lord's machinations can't compete with those of the South African judicial system. On August 3, 1959, 2 years and 8 months after our arrests, and after a full year of legal maneuvering, the actual trial commenced at the Old Synagogue in Pretoria. We were finally, formally arraigned, and all 30 of us pleaded not guilty. Our defense team was once again led by Izzy Maisels, and he was assisted by Sidney Kentridge, Bram Fischer, and Vernon Baranger. This time, at long last, the trial was in earnest. During the first 2 months of the case, the Crown entered some 2,000 documents into the record and called 210 witnesses, 200 of whom were members of the special branch. These detectives admitted to hiding in closets and under beds, posing as ANC members, perpetrating virtually any deception that would enable them to get information about our organization. Yet many of the documents the state submitted and the speeches they transcribed were public documents, public speeches, information available to all. As before, much of the Crown's evidence consisted of books, papers, and documents seized from the accused during numerous raids that took place between 1952 and 1956, as well as notes taken by the police at Congress meetings during this same period. As before, the reports by the special branch officers of our speeches were generally muddled. We used to joke that between the poor acoustics of the hall and the confused and inaccurate reports of the special branch detectives, we could be fined for what we did not say, imprisoned for what we could not hear, and hanged for what we did not do. Each day at lunchtime, we were permitted to sit outside in the spacious garden of a neighboring vicarage, where we were supplied with a meal cooked by the redoubtable Mrs. Tayanage Pile and her friends. They prepared a spicy Indian lunch for us almost every day, and also tea, coffee, and sandwiches during the morning and afternoon breaks. These respites were like tiny vacations from court, and were a chance for us to discuss politics with each other. Those moments under the shade of the jacaranda trees on the vicarage lawn were the most pleasant of the trial, for in many ways the case was more a test of our endurance than a trial of justice. On the morning of October 11th, as we were preparing to go to court, we heard an announcement on the radio that the prosecutor, Oswald Pirot, had died suddenly from a stroke. His death was a severe setback to the government, and the effectiveness and aggressiveness of the Crown team diminished from that point on. In court that day, Judge Rumpf gave an emotional eulogy to Pirot and praised his legal acumen and thoroughness. Although we would benefit from his absence, we did not rejoice at his death. We had developed a certain affection for our opponent, for despite Pirot's noxious political views, he was a humane man without the virulent personal racism of the government he was acting for. His habitual polite reference to us as Africans, even one of our own attorneys occasionally slipped and referred to us as natives, contrasted with his supremacist political leanings. In a curious way, our small world inside the old synagogue seemed balanced when, each morning, we observed Pirot reading the right-wing New Order at his table, and Bram Fischer reading the left-wing New Age at ours. His donation to us of the more than 100 volumes of the preparatory examination, free of charge, was a generous gesture that saved the defense a great deal of money. Advocate DeFosse became the new leader of the Crown's team, and could not match the eloquence or acuity of his predecessor. Shortly after Pirot's death, the prosecution concluded its submission of evidence. It was then that the prosecution began its examination of expert witnesses, commencing with the long-suffering Professor Murray, its supposed expert in communism, who had proved so inept in his subject during the preparatory examination. In a relentless cross-examination by Maisels, Murray admitted that the Charter was in fact a humanitarian document that might well represent the natural reaction and aspirations of non-whites to the harsh conditions in South Africa. Murray was not the only Crown witness who did little to advance the state's case. Despite the voluminous amount of Crown evidence and pages of testimony from their expert witnesses, the prosecution had not managed to produce any valid evidence that the ANC plotted violence, and they knew it. Then, in March, the prosecution displayed a new burst of confidence. They were about to release their most damning evidence. With great fanfare and a long drum roll in the press, the state played for the court a secretly recorded speech of Robert Reschers. The speech was given in his capacity as Transvaal Volunteer-in-Chief to a roomful of Freedom Volunteers in 1956, a few weeks before we were all to be arrested. The courtroom was very quiet, and despite the static of the recording and the background din, one could make out Robert's words very clearly. When you are disciplined and you are told by the organization not to be violent, you must not be violent. But if you are a true volunteer and you are called upon to be violent, you must be absolutely violent. You must murder. Murder. That is all. The prosecution believed it had sealed its case. Newspapers prominently featured Resch's words and echoed the sensibilities of the state. To the Crown, the speech revealed the ANC's true and secret intent, unmasking the ANC's public pretense of non-violence. But in fact, Resch's words were an anomaly. Robert was an excellent, if rather excitable, platform speaker, and his choice of analogy was unfortunate. But as the defense would show, he was merely emphasizing the importance of discipline and that the volunteer must do whatever he is ordered, however unsavory. Over and over, our witnesses would show that Resch's speech was not only taken out of context, but did not represent ANC policy. The prosecution concluded its case on March 10, 1960, and we were to call our first witness for the defense 4 days later. We had been in the doldrums for months, but as we started to prepare ourselves for our testimony, we were eager to go on the offensive. We had been parrying the enemy's attacks for too long. There had been much speculation in the press that our first witness would be Chief Luthuli. The Crown apparently believed that as well, for there was great consternation among the prosecution when, on March 14th, our first witness was not Luthuli, but Dr. Wilson Konko. Konko was the son of a Zulu cattle farmer from the beautiful Ixopo district of Natal. In addition to being a practicing physician, he had been one of the founders of the Youth League, an active participant in the Defiance campaign, and the treasurer of the ANC. As a preparation for his testimony, he was asked about his brilliant academic record at the University of the Witwatersrand, where he graduated first in his medical school class, ahead of all the sons and daughters of white privilege. As Konko's credentials were cited, I got the distinct impression that Justice Kennedy, who was also from Natal, seemed proud. Natalians are noted for their loyalty to their region, and these peculiar bonds of attachment can sometimes even transcend color. Indeed, many Natalians thought of themselves as white Zulus. Justice Kennedy had also seemed to be a fair-minded man, and I sensed that through Wilson Konko's example, he began to see us not as heedless rabble-rousers, but men of worthy ambitions, who could help their country if their country would only help them. At the end of Konko's testimony, when Konko was cited for some medical achievement, Kennedy said in Zulu, a language in which he was fluent, "We Zulus are like that." Dr. Konko proved a calm and articulate witness who reaffirmed the ANC's commitment to nonviolence. Chief Lutuli was next. With his dignity and sincerity, he made a deep impression on the court. He was suffering from high blood pressure, and the court agreed to sit only in the mornings while he gave evidence. His evidence in chief lasted several days, and he was cross-examined for nearly 3 weeks. He carefully outlined the evolution of the ANC's policy, putting things simply and clearly, and his former positions as teacher and chief imparted an added gravity and authority to his words. As a devout Christian, he was the perfect person to discuss how the ANC had sincerely strived for racial harmony. The chief testified to his belief in the innate goodness of man, and how moral persuasion plus economic pressure could well lead to a change of heart on the part of white South Africans. In discussing the ANC's policy of nonviolence, he emphasized that there was a difference between nonviolence and pacifism. Pacifists refused to defend themselves even when violently attacked, but that was not necessarily the case with those who espoused nonviolence. Sometimes men and nations, even when nonviolent, had to defend themselves when they were attacked. As I listened to Konko and Lutuli, I thought that here, probably for the first time in their lives, the judges were listening not to their domestic servants who said only what they knew their masters would like to hear, but to independent and articulate Africans spelling out their political beliefs and how they hoped to realize them. The chief was cross-examined by advocate Trengove, who doggedly attempted to get him to say the ANC was dominated by communists and had a dual policy of non-violence intended for the public and a secret plan of waging violent revolution. The chief steadfastly refuted the implications of what Trengove was suggesting. He himself was the soul of moderation, particularly as Trengove seemed to lose control. At one point, Trengove accused the chief of hypocrisy. The chief ignored Trengove's aspersion and calmly remarked to the bench, "My lord, I think the crown is running wild." But on March 21st, the chief's testimony was interrupted by a shattering event outside the courtroom. On that day, the country was rocked by an occurrence of such magnitude that when Chief Lutuli returned to testify a month later, the courtroom and all of South Africa was a different place. Chapter 33. The December 1959 ANC Annual Conference was held in Durban during that city's dynamic anti-pass demonstrations. The conference unanimously voted to initiate a massive countrywide anti-pass campaign beginning March 31st and climaxing on June 26th with a great bonfire of passes. The planning began immediately. On March 31st, deputations were sent to local authorities. ANC officials toured the country, talking to the branches about the campaign. ANC field workers spread the word in townships and factories. Leaflets, stickers, and posters were printed and circulated and posted in trains and buses. The mood of the country was grim. The state was threatening to ban the organization, with cabinet ministers warning the ANC that it would soon be battered with an ungloved fist. Elsewhere in Africa, the freedom struggle was marching on. The emergence of the Independent Republic of Ghana in 1957 and its pan-Africanist anti-apartheid leader Kwame Nkrumah had alarmed the nationalists and made them even more intent on clamping down on dissent at home. In 1960, 17 former colonies in Africa were scheduled to become independent states. In February, British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan visited South Africa and gave a speech before Parliament in which he talked of winds of change sweeping Africa. The PAC at the time appeared lost. They were a leadership in search of followers, and they had yet to initiate any action that put them on the political map. They knew of the ANC's anti-pass campaign and had been invited to join, but instead of linking arms with the Congress movement, they sought to sabotage us. The PAC announced that it was launching its own anti-pass campaign on March 21st, 10 days before ours was to begin. No conference had been held by them to discuss the date. No organizational work of any significance had been undertaken. It was a blatant case of opportunism. Their actions were motivated more by a desire to eclipse the ANC than to defeat the enemy. 4 days before the scheduled demonstration, Sobukwe invited us to join with the PAC. Sobukwe's offer was not a gesture of unity, but a tactical move to prevent the PAC from being criticized for not including us. He made the offer at the 11th hour, and we declined to participate. On the morning of March 21st, Sobukwe and his executive walked to the Orlando police station to turn themselves in for arrest. The tens of thousands of people going to work ignored the PAC men. In the magistrate's court, Sobukwe announced the PAC would not attempt to defend itself in accordance with their slogan, no bail, no defense, no fine. They believed the defiers would receive sentences of a few weeks, but Sobukwe was sentenced not to 3 weeks, but to 3 years imprisonment without the option of a fine. The response to the PAC's call in Johannesburg was minimal. No demonstrations at all took place in Durban, Port Elizabeth, or East London. But in Everton, Z.B. Molete, ably assisted by Joe Molefi and Vuzumuzi Maki, mustered the support of the entire township as several hundred men presented themselves for arrest without passes. Cape Town saw one of the biggest anti-pass demonstrations in the history of the city. In Langa Township, outside Cape Town, some 30,000 people, led by the young student Philip Kosan, gathered and were spurred to rioting by a police baton charge. 2 people were killed. But the last of the areas where demonstrations took place was the most calamitous and the one whose name still echoes with tragedy, Sharpeville. Sharpeville was a small township about 35 miles south of Johannesburg in the grim industrial complex around Vereeniging. PAC activists had done an excellent job of organizing the area. In the early afternoon, a crowd of several thousand surrounded the police station. The demonstrators were controlled and unarmed. The police force of 75 was greatly outnumbered and panicky. No one heard warning shots or an order to shoot, but suddenly the police opened fire on the crowd and continued to shoot as the demonstrators turned and ran in fear. When the area had cleared, 69 Africans lay dead, most of them shot in the back as they were fleeing. All told, more than 700 shots had been fired into the crowd, wounding more than 400 people, including dozens of women and children. It was a massacre, and the next day, press photos displayed the savagery on front pages around the world. The shootings at Sharpeville provoked national turmoil and a government crisis. Outraged protests came in from across the globe, including one from the American State Department. For the first time, the UN Security Council intervened in South African affairs, blaming the government for the shootings and urging it to initiate measures to bring about racial equality. The Johannesburg Stock Exchange plunged, and capital started to flow out of the country. South African whites began making plans to emigrate. Liberals urged Vervoort to offer concessions to Africans. The government insisted Sharpeville was the result of a communist conspiracy. The massacre at Sharpeville created a new situation in the country. In spite of the amateurishness and opportunism of their leaders, the PAC rank and file displayed great courage and fortitude in their demonstrations at Sharpeville and Langa. In just 1 day, they had moved to the front lines of the struggle, and Robert Sobukwe was being hailed inside and outside the country as the savior of the liberation movement. We in the ANC had to make rapid adjustments to this new situation, and we did so. A small group of us, Walter, Duma Nokwe, Joe Slovo, and myself, held an all-night meeting in Johannesburg to plan a response. We knew we had to acknowledge the events in some way and give the people an outlet for their anger and grief. We conveyed our plans to Chief Lithuli, and he readily accepted them. On March 26th in Pretoria, the chief publicly burned his pass, calling on others to do the same. He announced a nationwide stay-at-home on March 28th, a national day of mourning, and protest for the atrocities at Sharpeville. In Orlando, Duma Nokwe and I then burned our passes before hundreds of people and dozens of press photographers. 2 days later, on the 28th, the country responded magnificently as several hundred thousand Africans observed the chief's call. Only a truly mass organization could coordinate such activities, and the ANC did so. In Cape Town, a crowd of 50,000 met in Langa Township to protest the shootings. Rioting broke out in many areas. The government declared a state of emergency, suspending habeas corpus and assuming sweeping powers to act against all forms of subversion. South Africa was now under martial law. Chapter 34. At 1:30 in the morning on March 30th, I was awakened by sharp, unfriendly knocks at my door, the unmistakable signature of the police. "The time has come," I said to myself, as I opened the door to find half a dozen armed security policemen. They turned the house upside down, taking virtually every piece of paper they could find, including the transcripts I had recently been making of my mother's recollections of family history and tribal fables. I was never to see them again. I was then arrested without a warrant and given no opportunity to call my lawyer. They refused to inform my wife as to where I was to be taken. I simply nodded at Winnie. It was no time for words of comfort. 30 minutes later, we arrived at Newlands Police Station, which was familiar to me from the many occasions when I had visited clients there. The station was located in Sophiatown, or rather what was left of it, for the once bustling township was now a ruin of bulldozed buildings and vacant lots. Inside, I found a number of my colleagues who had been similarly rousted out of bed. And over the course of the night, more arrived. By morning, we totaled 40 in all. We were put in a cramped yard with only the sky as a roof and a dim bulb for light, a space so small and dank that we remained standing all night. At 7:15, we were taken into a tiny cell with a single drainage hole in the floor, which could be flushed only from the outside. We were given no blankets, no food, no mats, and no toilet paper. The hole regularly became blocked, and the stench in the room was insufferable. We issued numerous protests, among them the demand to be fed. These were met with surly rejoinders, and we resolved that the next time the door opened, we would surge out into the adjacent courtyard and refuse to return to the cell until we had been fed. The young policeman on duty took fright and left as we stampeded through the door. A few minutes later, a burly, no-nonsense sergeant entered the courtyard and commanded us to return to the cell. "Go inside," he yelled. "If you don't, I'll bring in 50 men with batons and we'll break your skulls." After the horrors of Sharpeville, the threat did not seem empty. The station commander approached the gate of the courtyard to observe us, and then came over and berated me for standing with my hands in my pockets. "Is that the way you act around an officer?" he yelled. "Take your bloody hands out of your pockets." I kept my hands firmly rooted in my pockets, as if I were taking a walk on a chilly day. I told him that I might condescend to remove my hands if we were fed. At 3 p.m., more than 12 hours after most of us had arrived, we were delivered a container of thin, mealy pap and no utensils. Normally, I would have considered this unfit for consumption, but we reached in with our unwashed hands and ate as though we had been provided with the most delicious delicacies under the sun. After our meal, we elected a committee to represent us, which included Duma Nokwe and Zibi Molete, the publicity secretary of the Pan-Africanist Congress, and me. I was elected spokesman. We immediately drew up a petition protesting the unfit conditions and demanding our immediate release on the grounds that our detention was illegal. At 6 o'clock, we received sleeping mats and blankets. I do not think words can do justice to a description of the foulness and filthiness of this bedding. The blankets were encrusted with dried blood and vomit, ridden with lice, vermin, and cockroaches, and reeked with a stench that actually competed with the odiousness of the drain. Near midnight, we were told we were to be called out, but for what we did not know. Some of the men smiled at the expectation of release. Others knew better. I was the first to be called, and I was ushered over to the front gate of the prison, where I was briefly released in front of a group of police officers. But before I could move, an officer shouted, "Name!" "Mandela," I said. "Nelson Mandela," the officer said. "I arrest you under the powers vested in me by the emergency regulations." We were not to be released at all, but re-arrested under the terms of what we only then discovered was a state of emergency. Each of us in turn was released for mere seconds, and then re-arrested. We had been arrested illegally before the state of emergency. Now we were being properly arrested under the state of emergency that came into force at midnight. We drafted a memorandum to the commander asking to know our rights. The next morning I was called to the commander's office, where I found my colleague, Robert Resha, who had been arrested and was being interrogated by the station commander. When I walked into the room, Resha asked the commander why he had erupted at me the previous night. His answer was that of the typical white boss. Mandela was cheeky. I responded, "I'm not bound to take my hands out of my pockets for the likes of you, then or now." The commander jumped out of his chair, but was restrained by other officers. At this moment, Special Branch Detective Sergeant Helberg entered the office and said, "Hello, Nelson," in a pleasant way, to which I shot back, "I am not Nelson to you. I am Mr. Mandela." The room was on the brink of becoming a full-scale battle when we were informed that we had to leave to attend the treason trial in Pretoria. I did not know whether to laugh or despair, but in the midst of this 36 hours of mistreatment and the declaration of a state of emergency, the government still saw fit to bring us back to Pretoria to continue their desperate and now seemingly outdated case against us. We were taken straight to Pretoria local prison, where we were detained. Chapter 35. In the meantime, court resumed in our absence on March 31st, but the witness box was conspicuously empty. Those who did attend were the accused whom the police had failed to pick up under the state of emergency. Chief Latuli had been in the middle of his evidence, and Judge Rampf asked for an explanation for his absence. He was informed that the chief had been taken into custody the night before. Judge Rampf expressed irritation with the explanation and said he did not see why the state of emergency should stand in the way of his trial. He demanded that the police bring the chief to court so that he could resume his testimony, and court was adjourned. Later we discovered that after the chief's arrest, he had been assaulted. He had been walking up some stairs when he was jostled by a warder, causing his hat to fall to the floor. As he bent to pick it up, he was smacked across the head and face. This was hard for us to take. A man of immense dignity and achievement, a lifelong devout Christian, and a man with a dangerous heart condition, was treated like a barnyard animal by men who were not fit to tie his shoes. When we were called back into session that morning, Judge Rump was informed that the police refused to bring the chief to court. The judge then adjourned court for the day, and we expected to go home. But as they were leaving the court grounds to find transportation, we were all once again rearrested. But the police, with their usual disorganized overzealousness, made a comical mistake. Wilton Mkwai, one of the accused and a longtime union leader and ANC man, had traveled to Pretoria for the trial from Port Elizabeth. Somehow he had gotten separated from his colleagues, and when he approached the gate and saw the commotion of his fellow accused being arrested, he asked a policeman what was going on. The policeman ordered him to leave. Wilton stood there. The policeman again ordered him to leave, whereupon Wilton informed the officer he was one of the accused. The officer called him a liar and threatened to arrest him for obstruction of justice. The officer then angrily ordered him to leave the area. Wilton shrugged his shoulders, walked out of the gate, and that was the last anyone saw of Wilton in court. He went underground for the next 2 months, successfully evading arrest, and then was smuggled out of the country, soon emerging as a foreign representative for the Congress of Trade Unions and later going for military training in China. That night, we were joined by detainees from other parts of the Transvaal. The countrywide police raid had led to the detention without trial of more than 2,000 people. These men and women belonged to all races and all anti-apartheid parties. A call-up of soldiers had been announced, and units of the army had been mobilized and stationed in strategic areas around the country. On April 8th, both the ANC and the PAC were declared illegal organizations under the Suppression of Communism Act. Overnight, being a member of the ANC had become a felony punishable by a term in jail and a fine. The penalty for furthering the aims of the ANC was imprisonment for up to 10 years. Now, even non-violent, law-abiding protests under the auspices of the ANC were illegal. The struggle had entered a new phase. We were now, all of us, outlaws. For the duration of the state of emergency, we stayed at Pretoria Local, where the conditions were as bad as those at Newlands. Groups of 5 prisoners were pressed into cells measuring 9 feet by 7 feet. The cells were filthy, with poor lighting and worse ventilation. We had a single sanitary pail with a loose lid and vermin-infested blankets. We were allowed outside for an hour a day. On our second day in Pretoria, we sent a deputation to complain about the conditions to the prison's commanding officer, Colonel Snyman. The colonel's response was rude and abrupt. He demanded that we produce evidence, calling our complaints lies. "You have brought the vermin into my prison from your filthy homes," he sneered. I said we also required a room that was quiet and well lit so that we could prepare for our case. The colonel was again contemptuous. "Government regulations do not require prisoners to read books, if you can read at all." Despite the colonel's disdainful attitude, the cells were soon painted and fumigated, and we were supplied with fresh blankets and sanitary pails. We were permitted to stay out in the yard for much of the day, while those of us involved in the treason trial were provided with a large cell for consultations, in which we were also permitted to keep legal books. Pretoria Local would be our home for the foreseeable future. We would leave for the trial in the morning and return to the prison in the afternoon. The prison, according to apartheid dictates, separated detainees by color. We were, of course, already separated from our white colleagues, but the separation from our Indian and colored comrades within the same non-white facility seemed like madness. We demanded to be accommodated together, and were given all sorts of absurd explanations why this was impossible. When the proverbial inflexibility of red tape is combined with the petty small-mindedness of racism, the result can be mind-boggling. But the authorities eventually yielded, allowing the treason trialists to be kept together. Although we were kept together, our diet was fixed according to race. For breakfast, Africans, Indians, and coloreds received the same quantities, except that Indians and coloreds received a half teaspoonful of sugar, which we did not. For supper, the diets were the same, except that Indians and coloreds received 4 ounces of bread, while we received none. This latter distinction was made on the curious premise that Africans did not naturally like bread, which was a more sophisticated or Western taste. The diet for white detainees was far superior to that for Africans. So color-conscious were the authorities that even the type of sugar and bread supplied to whites and non-whites differed. White prisoners received white sugar and white bread, while colored and Indian prisoners were given brown sugar and brown bread. We complained vociferously about the inferior quality of the food, and as a result, our advocate, Sidney Kentridge, made a formal complaint in court. I stated that the food was unfit for human consumption. Judge Rumpf agreed to sample the food himself and that day went out to do so. Samp and beans was the best meal that the prison prepared, and in this case, the authorities put in more beans and gravy than usual. Judge Rumpf ate a few spoonfuls and pronounced the food well-cooked and tasty. He did allow that it should be served warm.